This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. New U.S. citizen Mauricio Sutikoff of Bloomington says there's a lot of bureaucracy in becoming a citizen. He even had to leave a legal job once because of hoop jumping.
The employment authorization I had to be renewed within a four-month period, but it took them 6 months to get me the renewal.
More than 100 Central Illinois residents became citizens last week. Plus, some teenagers who feel out of place in the regular school environment turned to McLean County Youth Bill. Bill Power report. GLT correspondent Willis Kern is not a blowhard, but he reports on some people who are blowing hard to keep lung capacity healthy with harmonica therapy. And the mayor of Bloomington stops by. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington City Council has rejected a request for a liquor license from a business that wanted to open on Morris Avenue near Miller Park. Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with GLT's Ryan Dunham to talk about that vote and more from last night's City Council meeting.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan. Great to be here.
So this vote last night, the council rejecting the liquor license request from Park Pantry, happened in part because of a lot of neighborhood opposition. Many neighbors said that they did not want another place where you could buy alcohol in that neighborhood. What did you think of the council's decision, this 5-4 vote to reject the license?
Well, I think ultimately, obviously, it does reflect the division on the council. The Liquor Commission was 2-1 in favor of it. But it is this classic trade-off between what some of the neighbors are saying, at least some of the more vocal neighbors. There were some that were in favor of it. And then on the other hand, economic development. It is a site that we want to encourage investment, especially over $500,000 investment that the proprietor was proposing in a convenience store. Convenience stores in Bloomington Normal and most places do typically involve selling some sort of alcohol. There's only one in Bloomington Normal that does not currently. So that was not an unreasonable request. This person has a good record. I think, you know, it would have been a positive for the neighborhood. But, and there were lots of restrictions on that, by the way. We made sure that it's a liquor commission. He had to close at 11 o'clock at night. There had to be cameras. There had to be lighting, automatic lighting. They could not sell single serves. And so when we would go back and monitor them, you know, within 6 months, because their alcohol sales had to be well under 50% of their sales. So there were a variety of, you know, conditions. And the council was divided, even, you know, many of those who voted no. So it really was a tough vote and a very, very tough decision to make.
Hmm. Were there other conditions that you could have considered at the Liquor Commission level that might have got this over the 5-4 vote into a supportive position from the council?
That's an excellent question. I'd not have thought about that myself. But possibly the only other thing we could have said, I mean, we had single serves 24 ounces and below, and that's partly because bottles of wine are 25.3 ounces. So we wanted them to sell a bottle of wine if you wanted to pick up a bottle of wine for dinner or something. But we could conceivably have, and one of the aldermen mentioned last night, no single serves for alcohol or beer below 32 ounces or something like that. And I thought maybe that would precipitate an amendment. It did not. I don't know. That might have been the only thing. I mean, pretty much we put all the teeth into it that we possibly could have, you know, at the Liquor Commission. And as I say, even the Liquor Commission was divided.
Hmm. And, you know, you being technically the city's liquor commissioner, mm-hmm. It sounds like you would have... You talk about a spectrum here, right? So
right.
You got to balance the economic development side versus the
right.
neighborhood concern side. It sounds like, from what you're saying, that you probably would have gone ahead with this.
Yes, and I did. I mean, at the Liquor Commission, I had one liquor commissioner say no, And one liquor commissioner say yes. And so they were divided. And in a sense, I broke the tie and said yes, but I did, you know, talk to, you know, in the meeting to the neighbors who were there and try to explain why. And also to the proprietor to say, you know, in a sense, we will be watching you if this is approved. No, it needed to be also approved by the city council, which obviously it was rejected last night by 5-4. And so, you know, we will see what happens with that property. It is a property, if you've ever been out there, that really cries for something. And so as mayor, I think that as, you know, mayor and liquor commissioner, we could certainly have monitored it. The sins of the 47-year liquor store of the past, I don't think are fair to totally put on the new proprietor. The police have said that, you know, they didn't seem to have any issues with that, you know, sort of serious issues. So for a variety of reasons, I would have gone forward with that $500,000-some investment. But while we might have been on the prevailing side on the Liquor Commission, that was not the case with the city council. And obviously we have to accept that and move forward and try to make progress in other ways.
So either after the meeting or sometime today, has the city heard from the person who wanted to open Park Pantry, this Ajit Singh, or his attorney, to see where his head is at this point, if he's going to come back or try to do something else with that property? Is there any sense of what he might do next?
No, I think it was pretty clear that in order to make a convenience store work, as I say, we've only got one in all of Bloomington Normal that does not sell alcohol. So I think he needed a liquor license. And certainly a resident suggested that he operate without liquor for 6 months and let's see how we like you. The problem with that is he's then would obviously have invested his $590,000 or $580,000 into the establishment and may not be making a profit. And then if in 6 months he doesn't get a liquor license, he spent all that money on a business that's not profitable. So I can understand where he's coming from. I understand certainly where the residents are coming from. And we were trying to come up with or fashion a reasonable compromise.
So last night was an example of the city council listening to community concerns about, in this case, alcohol sales. You know, this is the same council that also enacted a moratorium on new video gambling machines. I don't know. What do you think that we're learning about where this council is on these so-called, you know, issues of vice, these things that are legal but also have a darker component to it if abused?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I think that's still forming. Some of it is, you know, again, we have 4 out of 9 council members that have only been serving a couple months, and it takes a while to begin to kind of sift through all of the social media chatter as opposed to the concerns. I prefer people just tell you one-on-one, or when they come to my open houses, you know, they, you know, we can talk and kind of work through some things. I prefer that kind of communication because anybody can say whatever they want on social media. So I tend to view that as noise. And if you really want to come talk to me in my open house, or at least email me or something, or give me a phone call, whatever. So I think that's something that takes a little while to learn. Again, I was on the county board for 12 years before being mayor. So you get some sense of how you kind of go through some triage there. You know, those that are the most strong, credible voices, those that, you know, maybe aren't so credible, but they've got some good points, and those that, frankly, are sometimes just making stuff up and don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting, too, as the marijuana legalization stuff rolls out.
Yes.
I mean, that's a very – it's a sort of an analog, parallel issue where the council could face a decision about a vice-related thing.
Oh, we will. There's no question about that. We will. And actually, Alderwoman Carrillo last night had asked to form a task force, and she's going to be talking about that. And that actually seems like a reasonable request for me. I'm glad that the council is going to begin to talk about it, because one way or another, it's going to happen. We're going to have to face that issue. And so being prepared in advance, I think, is a very good thing.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here in studio with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Mayor Renner, less than a week ago, we learned that State Farm has decided to demolish its former headquarters building in downtown Bloomington after its initial plans to sell the building fell through. WGLT, we spoke to you a few hours after that was announced, but now that some time has passed, what do you make of that decision and what it could mean for downtown?
Well, I think if it were to go through, obviously it would be bad for downtown. And I will do everything I can, and I think the council is united in trying to do everything that we can to prevent demolition of the State Farm building downtown. And there are many things that we are working on right now over the next couple of weeks, and we will see whether or not they bear fruit.
So the demolishing decision was a bit surprising to at least us on the outside world, folks in the media. We thought a sale was going to be happening.
Right.
How much warning do you and the city get when a decision like that is made?
Well, it depends on the decision. In this case, we heard, I believe Tim Gleason heard about 90 minutes before it was released, and Tim called me. So I probably heard maybe 85 minutes or so, you know, before it happened. It obviously was surprising. It wasn't totally shocking because we know that it's been something that they've been interested in and acting upon. But certainly there's certainly still some options that I think we can pursue in working with State Farm over the next few weeks.
Does that strike you as odd that the city only gets a hour and a half heads up on something like that?
Well, I think that's up to the individual business or whatever. I mean, the State Farm owns the building, or whoever, decides on doing whatever they're going to do. You know, private businesses can do what they'd like to do. So I don't know what the timetable was at their end or what other things they were facing. That's really hard to say. Obviously, I'm not in their shoes, so I can't really comment on that.
Because it seems like if the city, you and the city manager, is interested in trying to stop demolition from happening, finding some other solution here, it feels like those negotiations could have been happening, behind the scenes before an announcement is made like this. It strikes me, the timing seems odd.
Yes, I think that we've certainly been in touch with State Farm from the moment that they decided that they wanted to sell the building. We've had a lot of conversations with the people who were the potential buyers and their agents about how we might help try to promote the renting out of the various floors. And that's some of it, is just the nature. I mean, it's an incredible building for us. It's got great historic value. And as we understand, it's in pretty good shape. But it is somewhat awkward. It's not the obvious building that a single business or even two businesses would just come in and occupy. You'd have to have lots of different tenants. And so there could be any number of possibilities moving forward, and those are, things that we want to explore. But certainly I'm committed, and as I say, the council's committed to doing anything we can to prevent demolition.
Well, to that end, there is a new part of the city's zoning code that is what's called a demolition review process, where
correct.
Once a property owner is pursuing demolition, they file that permit. That permit goes through a review process if the building is X number of years old. That's a very formal way for the city to try to intervene.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're talking about a more informal conversation.
I'm talking about much more informal, absolutely.
Yeah, is that mechanism, though, something you think the city would employ if these informal talks don't yield what you want?
That would really have to be up to the council and the zoning board. That's not something necessarily that I would advocate. I think at this point we're having informal conversations.
Gotcha. Well, there are a lot of government agencies, government things that are downtown that
right.
may or may not be looking for homes, right? Connect Transit is looking for a spot to put a transfer center. The library has talked about needing more space.
Even City Hall,
Normal
has put in two City Halls since we built ours. Ours, as I joke, was built in the era of Mad Men. It's just we don't have the alcohol and the tobacco that's used in it compared to episodes of Mad Men. So I believe it was 1960 that it was built. So
do you think there's a government use potentially for a building like the State Farm building?
Not the whole thing, but for certainly for parts of it, yes.
So the current City Hall, as you say, is from the era of Mad Men. In what ways is it not is I mean you that's a joke, but in what ways is it actually not meeting the city's needs? Is it are there
it's things we're it's way doing? Too big for it's, that? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, we're way too big, and we have. I mean, it was built in a time where Bloomington had 30-some thousand people, and we have now 80,000 people. We have a $220 million budget. We've got many other needs. It's also, frankly, if we have serious investors coming from out of town that might want to invest. It's embarrassing to meet in my office, for example. So now we might, it's better to meet in Chris Koos's office or to meet in other places. But basically, it's the same stained carpet that was there 27, 28 years ago, even the same furniture, the same everything. And certainly when I came in, the city manager had said, you know, what do you want to do to redecorate your office? And I said, nothing. No, I don't want to spend any, you know, taxpayer money on it. But we do have downtown artists. Who have are displaying their works in the city at no cost to taxpayers, of course. So some of that was, you know, there's a variety of reasons why the current city hall is not really a showcase for much of anything other than maybe 1960 or 1961.
So right after State Farm said that it was planning to demolish the building downtown, City Manager Tim Gleason, we got a statement from him, and one of the things he said was, quote, today's announcement is a reality that must be accepted. So that statement makes it sound like it's a done deal and the city's willing to accept demolition. So I guess what changed between then and now?
I think their decision is a reality. I don't know that it's a reality that is to be accepted that we can't do anything about and that we might not have some informal conversations about. Including, obviously, would have to involve Mr. Gleason as a city manager, as well as myself as mayor. And then if some things bear fruit, then we branch out from there. And so I would say stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We will be staying tuned. But if nothing does change, if State Farm does move ahead with this in a few months, demolition process begins, takes a year or more. We can actually see the State Farm building be demolished before the front and center building. And I want to ask, is
that's a crime.
Would that be a disappointing prospect to you to see that the order
disappointing
of that
doesn't even touch that, Ryan. Yeah, the front. This is another question, another example of about downtown development is obviously, you know, you're often dealing with, as you are, many, many different stakeholders, sometimes even on the same block as with the front and center building. There's actually two owners. The front and center block, not the building. And some will acquire properties and just let them rot. Not State Farm, of course, but the front and center building. And it's the largest fire hazard in our downtown.
Well, I feel like I've asked you...
It's a strategic property, you know.
This question, though, I've asked you this question probably for a year or two now. You know, is the city any closer today than it was a year ago to pursuing eminent domain or some sort of legal maneuver to try to get front and center?
Yes. I can't say much more than that because it's a legal issue. But it's a much longer, much more complicated process than if you could just sit down and work out a fair market deal for somebody. The one thing that is critical that certainly the people in Uptown learned is if you own property, you can control it. If you don't own the property, then you can't. And that can be a serious problem in trying to have the highest and best usage for your properties. If you think about Uptown 15 years ago, you had vacant buildings, vacant lots, an EPA Superfund waste site, and now it's an engine of economic growth. And that was because you had determined political leadership over a long period of time, two decades, continue to push. And I can assure you, I'm determined. Our situation is different. We've got a larger area. We've got good bones. We don't have as many problems with vacant buildings and vacant properties. We've got different challenges. And we also don't have ISU right next door to us.
Nor do you have an Uptown mural.
No, we do not have an Uptown mural. But we do have a mural that welcomes you into the city of Bloomington on Market Street. A beautiful mural that I hope is award-winning.
That is Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. 2 weeks from now, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a way forward for kids who don't exactly fit in the traditional school model. That's on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Central Illinois gained nearly 100 new U.S. citizens Friday. Dana Vollmer reports on the naturalization ceremony in Peoria.
It was standing room only as family, friends, and supporters watched 88 Central Illinoisans take the oath of allegiance and officially become American citizens. Collectively, they represent 32 home countries, but many have lived in the U.S. for decades, and the journey to citizenship has been a long one. Mauricio Sadikoff is originally from Brazil. He's lived in the U.S. for 22 years.
It takes a long time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money and just bureaucracy. One time I had to leave a company I was working in legally because the employment authorization I had to be renewed within a four-month period, but it took them 6 months to get me the renewal.
Sadikoff lost his job because of the delay and had to wait to reapply until the work visa finally came through. He says his experience is not uncommon.
It's just a lot of hoops that we have to jump through. It's not an easy process to become an American. I don't know that it should be easy, but it probably shouldn't be this hard.
In order to become a U.S. citizen, a person must have their green card for at least 5 years. They also have to read, write, and speak basic English and be determined to be a person of good moral character. Then there's another 10 steps before the naturalization ceremony. Genesis Regal Buendia is a volunteer coordinator with the Immigration Project, a nonprofit that provides affordable legal services to immigrants in central and southern Illinois. She says a lot of people get stuck on step one, getting a green card in the first place.
The line in order to apply and get a green card, to just apply for it, not even to get it, is for some countries over 100 years.
Regalo Buendia herself just became a citizen that day. Her parents brought her to the United States from the Philippines on a work visa. They had to wait 10 years for their green card applications to be processed, and then another 5 years to apply for citizenship.
The U.S., my home for most of my life, is now my actual home on paper. It's unfortunate that there are other people trying to get in our position that cannot call this home the same despite being there for even longer than me.
People like Arti Subramanian, who came to the U.S. from India in 2002 and watched her citizenship application hang in limbo from the Bush administration on through the Trump administration.
It's getting harder day by day. I hear people who are waiting behind us for the filing, they are hearing more horror stories than us.
When the honorees crossed the stage in the basement of the Peoria Public Library, they gained a host of new rights. They can register to vote, apply for a passport to travel freely out of the country, avoid the hassle of extra paperwork when applying for jobs or colleges, and they have a better chance of keeping their families together. Subramanian says there's another benefit.
Honestly speaking, it's a pride to say that I am a citizen of America.
U.S. District Judge James Shadid officiated the ceremony, in which he administered the same oath and the same certificate of citizenship his grandparents received after emigrating from Lebanon a century ago.
1919, they arrived here. My grandpa became a citizen in 1930.
Shadid said the event was a reminder of the opportunity he's had because of the decision they made. In his remarks, Shadid pointed out the divisiveness of immigration politics and criticized the unnecessary degrading of people. Sadikoff from Brazil says he's received nothing but support from his community.
But it is really weird to have a president that essentially tries to make me less of an American now that I'm going to get naturalized than somebody that just happened to be born here.
And now Sadikoff says he finally has the power to do something about it.
Now I get to have a political say, so I don't think that it is a positive thing to try to create two classes of citizenship. I think if you're a citizen, and you should be treated as such.
With their certificate and a small American flag in hand, newly minted citizens return to what is finally, officially their home. I'm Dana Vollmer.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Americans are more polarized than at any other time since the Civil War.
The levels of political division we see in the country are profoundly destabilizing to our government, to our economy, to our culture. And it's just all this hate and bitterness that circulates in our country, and it could get worse.
So how do we fix it? Find out next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit. Get connected with Connect Transit 7 days a week. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Willis Kern's story on harmonica therapy. When Bloomington Normal teenagers Megan McClure and Marianne Cleveland attended public school, they felt the environment didn't support their goals. They felt out of place and overlooked. GLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson has this story about how they took an alternative route to success through Youth Build McLean County.
Megan McClure is a 17-year-old from Normal. One of the biggest reasons why she left public school was because of her social anxiety. Now she's enrolled in Youth Build, where she's studying information technology.
So going to Youth Build and having such an accepting community that will talk to me and check up on me and make sure that I'm always at my tip-top, it's really just the best experience.
There are over 200 Youth Build sites across the country. Each site gives teens who are unemployed or left high school the opportunity to reclaim their education, gain the skills needed to start their careers, and even become leaders in their communities. Youth Build is an accredited high school and offers vocational training as well. Career paths include residential construction, IT, and even healthcare. A new CNA program will launch in the fall. Before Youth Build, Megan said she had no idea what she wanted to do for a career. Now she knows it's something in IT. Her recent work at Youth Build included going to the Boys and Girls Club to teach kids about internet safety and cyberbullying.
I really took IT to heart, and it's really opened what I want to do, like the possibilities of what I can do. And I just know that I want to do something that will make my voice heard. So even like maybe being on the radio like this IT has really opened the possibilities for me and made me realize how big of, there's just so many different ties that IT has into the community. Again, with technology being so big nowadays, there is just so many things that I could do. There's so many things I want to do. There's not just a set plan yet.
16-year-old Amarianne Cleveland from Normal has put in over 600 hours of volunteer work with Youth Build. He's volunteered at Miller Park Zoo, the Boys and Girls Club, and Pet Central. He's studying construction now, but eventually wants to go to college to study audio engineering to support his passion for music. His favorite part about being enrolled in Youth Build is similar to Megan's.
Being noticed, really. Because, like, at every other school I was at, I've never really been noticed. Or, like, I never stood out to people, I guess. But here, I'm just like, I'm a leader, and I feel appreciated.
Last month, the National Youth Build hosted its 30th annual Conference of Young Leaders in Arlington, Virginia. Megan and Amarian were unanimously selected for the McLean County site by staff and peers to attend the conference for their outstanding record of community service, attendance, and academics.
When we did go to Washington, D.C., we met all those people who have gone through the Youth Build program and succeeded, and they were all so successful. I mean, they were there that day, helping all of us and showing us around such a big place with so many important people, and it would just show that Youth Build really does have an impact on people. So I don't think I could ever leave Youth Build and never come back.
Youth Build McLean County has provided education and youth development services for 25 years, but the last year has been especially difficult. A spike of gun violence in 2018 directly impacted Youth Build, including some of its former students. And that youth-involved violence has continued into 2019. Two teenagers were shot in Bloomington just this month. Here's Youth Build Executive Director Tracy Paulson.
So I think that one of the things that Youth Build is really good at doing, and that's serving young people. And we do that in any capacity. This last year was a hard year for our community because some of all of the young people that were lost were tremendous people. They added great things to the experiences that we had at Youth Build, as well as they were a big part of a lot of really positive things in the community, too. I think as a school, one of the things that we're really good at is loving young people and trying to figure out the best way that we can serve them. I think that as a youth-serving organization, one of the things that we really had to stop and look at is, are we doing everything that we can do to support? And I think the answer was no. We do a lot of things. just about everything you can possibly imagine, we try to cover at Youth Build. But there were other things that we needed to do, too. We needed to start talking about how we could empower young people to make good decisions when they weren't in school, when they weren't around those influential adults. We had to start talking about ways that we could train young people to take responsibility for making good decisions. And I think we also had to address how we could positively influence the time when young people were not at Youth Build or involved in other positive activities. So we reached out to a number of our partners. We convened groups of young people and talked to them about things that were happening in the neighborhoods and the streets. We don't have it all figured out. But I think that one thing that was really clear after the events that happened last summer is that we are a landing zone for young people when they're in trouble, when they're happy, when they're celebrating, and we're going to continue to be that place. And we serve young people who've had incredible backgrounds, and we're going to continue to do that because we've been able to see a lot of success and a lot of really wonderful things, too. We're going to love our young people, and we're going to hold on to them as hard as we can because we don't know what tomorrow will bring, and that's all we can do.
So what do you think it says about the importance of programs like Youth Build? When we see the alternative and the bad that can happen, what do you think that says about how important it is for us to have this type of program?
So I definitely think that I feel very confidently that our community is better because Youth Build has been in here, been in place. One of the greatest parts of my job is getting to spend time with the young people that we serve and the young people that we have served and the young people that we will serve in the future and hearing about how they were able to accomplish their goals and their dreams, hearing how they're able to support their families, hearing about how they're sober, hearing about how they were able to secure their own home. You know, we've been a part of those journeys with a lot of people in this community, and we hope to continue to do that. I think that this summer was a wake-up call that there's still work to be done and that it is a community effort, and Youth Build is certainly a viable partner that's here to play. We're willing to do whatever we can to serve young people, including finding them other places if that's where they need to be. We're committed to serving the young people that sometimes are a little hard to serve.
Paulson says they are still looking for more students.
Of course, recruiting for the fall semester or the fall term. So if there are any young people that are really struggling in those traditional streams, they should come and talk to us because there may be a place for them at Youth Build. You know, our goal is to figure out work with the student on how to figure out the best pathway to finish their education. And we're looking for young people who are ready to make positive changes in their lives. We try to accept everyone into Youth Build and try to find a place for them. But it's not a cakewalk. It's going to be a challenge. But for anyone who's up for some positive changes in their lives, then we're definitely the place.
That's Youth Build Executive Director Tracy Paulson and Youth Build students Marianne Cleveland and Megan McClure with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, what's next for one of the oldest head shops in the region? Every month, a handful of people gather on Bloomington's east side to make music together. As WGLT's Willis Kern reports, the tunes they produce aren't headed to the top of the charts, but the sounds are likely to improve their lives.
That's Nashville-based singer-songwriter and harmonica player extraordinaire Chris Jansen. The three-time Academy of Country Music Award nominee suffers from asthma, and 3 years ago signed on to become the national spokesman for a program called Harmonicas for Health. It's an effort designed to help those with breathing difficulties improve quality of life by regularly blowing into what's known by some older users as a mouth harp. One such disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, or COPD, is the third leading cause of death, with an estimated 24 million sufferers in the United States alone. On the third Tuesday of each month, a half dozen or so Central Illinois residents, all with breathing difficulties, gather in a conference room at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center's cardiopulmonary wing.
Make sure that we're all sitting up straight, feet flat on the floor, shoulders back. Remember, in here, the darker numbers are actually your breathing in, and then the numbers that are outlined, you are breathing out. Okay, so you're blowing
today,
out.
Today, Kraft is leading the group, all puffing arduously into harmonicas supplied to them for free by OSF. Kraft says good posture is a must for improved breathing.
We really try to focus on really breathing deeply, making sure that they're using their full lung function. This is kind of just like a different spin that we throw on top of it, playing a harmonica, playing beautiful music.
But while practicing better breathing techniques is designed to help, Kraft says the harmonica therapy also creates a positive social activity for each individual.
The goals of it really are to try to keep people not only socializing with everybody, but also focusing on that deep breathing. Whether you have pulmonary hypertension or COPD or something like that, you really, really want to try to show them that using the harmonica, sucking in, blowing out, really is going to try to help with that COPD and the pulmonary hypertension.
One of the four harmonica players is Steve Peterson. The retired rural McLean County resident has played harmonica for years and has been coming to the harmonica therapy sessions since they began nearly a year ago. He helps a first-time participant learn how to hit the correct notes to When the Saints Go Marching In.
You know the song. Yeah. So it's just like, well, you got to find the right note. It's hump and peck, right, like a right, piano. It's right, like that isn't right, but that is right. So once you find it, your brain sends you back to that spot, you know.
So again, too, I mean, when you're looking, see, we don't sound anything like that.
I don't know. No, very good.
No,
you in a band?
No, we're talking about us. No.
No, I sat around a campfire for 50 years.
Peterson says he's been battling breathing problems for years, but doctors have set him straight on just what to expect.
I got diagnosed 5 years ago. I had 50% lung function. I'm down to about 30%. So I don't have any illusions that, you know, this is going to extend my life and I'm going to live till I'm 105, but it does make you feel better. So that's the key, you know, and I mean, whether it's this or respiratory rehab or cardiac rehab, it makes you feel better, which is the key to daily living with chronic disease.
Peterson and the group practice on simple tunes to help ease the stress on the harmonica playing newbies. Facilitator Jessica Kraft says some of the simplest and easiest to learn songs are holiday tunes.
Christmas songs. We have Up on the Housetop, Deck the Halls.
See how bad we can butcher Silent Night.
That's a hard song.
That is it? A very hard song. Yeah, I think we've tried that before.
You're doing good.
Lynn Scott, who played Silent Night, shrugged off the praise. She said she comes to the harmonica therapy because it helps her feel less isolated.
You meet a lot of people that are kind of in the same boat as you are, so that makes you feel not so like you're the only one, because none of my friends have lung issues.
So again, make sure.
With Silent Night in the rearview mirror, the group dials back the degree of difficulty.
Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Yay! That was good! That was good! All right, how do we feel?
Dizzy.
All right, well, hey, you know what? That comes with it. Uh-huh. So just make sure we're practicing our pursed-lip breathing throughout this whole thing, okay? In through that nose, smell the flowers, blow out through the mouth, blowing out that birthday candle. Afterwards, if you are not out of breath in some way, shape, or form, lightheaded, dizzy, something like that, even though please do not continue doing it if you are dizzy, okay? Just stop whenever you need to. But typically, if you experience any type of those symptoms or something, you are doing it correctly. you're exercising those lungs like you need to.
Mary Jo Bragg of Lexington says she has noticed improvement in her breathing after taking just two sessions of the therapy.
It kind of makes me a little more conscious of how I should be inhaling and exhaling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think it does help.
At the end of each session, Kraft asks the group if they're willing to share any concerns they have about their chronic health conditions. Bragg says she's struggling with the high humidity and how that adds to the struggle of getting by in hot weather. Peterson says the heat and humidity caused him to miss out on an important family outing.
My family's going to see the Cubs Wednesday, and I'm not going because it's 90 degrees, yeah. And I can't breathe.
Yeah.
So I can't make it from the train station to Wrigley Field and up in my seat because I can't breathe. I'll be hyperventilating and calling 911. You know, so I stay home in the air conditioning.
Oh, when the saints go marching in.
Exercise physiologist and facilitator Jessica Kraft says the group is looking to expand the harmonica therapy group sizes. She says, though they're designed for people coping with breathing issues, that's not a prerequisite. She says sessions are open for anyone and they're free. The more people attend, the more beautiful the music, she says. She smiles coyly as she describes the result that way, beautiful music. One of the therapy participants described it as making a joyful noise. I'm Willis Kern.
The hour-long harmonica therapy sessions are held at 2 p.m. the third Tuesday of every month in OSF St. Joseph Medical Center's cardiopulmonary wing. The next session is August 20th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Every month, a handful of people gather on Bloomington's East Side to make music together, and Willis Kern will have that story online at WGLT.org as well. Governor J.B. Pritzker made good on his promise when he signed recreational cannabis into law last month. While anticipation runs high among Illinois residents, smoke shops across the state are preparing for what they hope is an influx of customers. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with the owner of one of America's oldest head shops nestled in Uptown Normal. Mike Williams runs Mother Murphy's with his wife, Becky.
Mother Murphy's was opened by Betty Anderson and Charlotte Ratka back in 1968 to cater to the growing hippie nation. It was kind of reaching the Midwest a little later than the coast, but it was the first shop that would set up and sell black lights and posters and smoking accessories, as well as they were specializing in silver and leather and things like that. That was very popular fad wear, you know, for hippies and such back in when I was young, was just a kid. Mother Murphy's has been going for 51 years now, and it's been almost in the same location except for 2 years. But we're carrying on the tradition that those ladies started way back then.
Now, we know cannabis isn't legalized yet. Medical marijuana is legalized in the state. There are medical dispensaries for that purpose. So what are you allowed to sell since cannabis is not yet legalized now?
Well, as far as selling smoking accessories go, we've never stopped selling smoking accessories. We kind of pulled back with some of the styles of water pipes and things in the 80s and things, but we've always sold smoking accessories. And the truth about it is that anything that can be smoked with tobacco can also be used with marijuana. They're totally interchangeable. And so the law has to be based on intent, which is much harder to prove. But as far as the new laws, when the medical passed and the dispensary opened, we kind of talked with some of the people that were running the medical dispensaries and were offering medical patients, if they had a medical card, 10% discounts on their smoking accessories. And as far as the new laws goes, we're very excited about that because we figure there's probably going to be a lot of people that would be reluctant to maybe try in the past because of the law, as well as people that have probably experimented in their youth that might be getting close to retirement age like myself and that maybe want to try it again. So I expect there will be a rise in use and probably a rise in sales of smoking accessories, I'm certainly hoping.
Mother Murphy's may be one of the oldest head shops with a steady clientele, but Smoker's Euphoria is one of the new kids on the block.
Co-owner Javelin Lawrence tells WGLT her take on a head shop is less about smoke and more about smart.
Smoker's Euphoria, we are a head/vapor shop. However, our customer base are a little bit different than your average smoke shop. We cater more to medicinal cannabis patients. So our patients come in to get more education in regards to cannabis or CBD.
So you don't necessarily have a direct tie to the recreational marijuana users. As you mentioned, you focus on, you know, vaping and medical users. So what are your thoughts on how the legalization of recreational use could impact your shop?
In general, I think that it would be a benefit just from the standpoint of being able to purchase items that a recreational consumer would need. However, even though we will provide those things, we will still focus more on the educational part of it. If you were to come to buy a particular item, we would want to explain to you how to use it and how to effectively use the product to get the most medicinal value out of the product, more so than just smoking to smoke. So for us, we really focus on the education part of cannabis.
Could you explain how there is the education aspect? You know, what is something that you might attempt to teach someone who comes in wanting to buy something who is a recreational user? What's something that maybe they'd need to know?
Well, for the average person that comes in who would like to purchase, for example, a water pipe, we want to make sure that they're getting enough filtration in so they're not getting as much carcinogens in their lungs, and also make sure that they understand how to clean it properly and how to use it effectively. Also, if they choose to use a device rather than, say, a water pipe, we want to make sure they understand the right temperature to smoke at it so that they get the most medicinal value out of it versus just smoking it and not understanding that the higher temperatures, they're not going to get as much out of it as they would if they were to burn it with a regular lighter. So we would want to educate them more on that level.
And can you explain what some of those medicinal benefits would be?
For a cannabis user, for example, I have multiple sclerosis. So for me, smoking is not necessarily the best value that I would get out of cannabis. I prefer more tinctures. So then I would want to make sure that they're getting the right amount of tinctures that they need for their body based on their weight and based on the severity of their disease. So for them, I would, you know, calculate if you get this much CBD, how much should you have, and make sure that they're getting that in, and I also make sure they're getting that amount in. And then I'll also encourage them to keep a journal. That way they know if a product is effective for them. So they would know what strands they have, how much they're consuming, how they felt before they had taken it, how they felt afterwards. And by keeping the journal, they're able to see the benefits of it. Because most people, when they take something, 10 minutes later, you forget why you've taken it, or you forget if you don't feel pain because you just assume that it's working. And some people don't always know that it's working. But if they see over time and they can track, then they'll be able to know if it's working for them or not. And then if it's not working for them, then we can switch to a different product.
You mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that your shop is catered toward the medical users of cannabis. Obviously, recreational use is not legal yet. When it is, it's not like you're going to be turning those people away.
Oh, no, we wouldn't turn anyone away. When you come to our shop, I try to make sure that everybody is welcome. I try to make sure that they're getting the best product. So we would not turn anyone away. So even though we cater more to medicinal patients, students, anyone is welcome as long as they understand that we try to educate more so than just purchase a product. So we're not the type of shop that is pushy and say, hey, I want you to buy this. I want you to get the best product and have the best experience when you come to our shop.
Do you think your overall customer base is going to grow after the legalization takes effect January 1st?
I think it will, but, you know, like with the average smoke shops, you can't advertise the way you can with any other retail shop. So a lot of it is word of mouth. So it's people letting other people know that our shop exists, people letting other people know the type of services that we provide. So for us, of course, we hope it does pick up. But I think once it becomes legal, it will definitely increase.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Ryan Denham, Willis Kern, Mary Cullen, and Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington. Thanks to him for stopping by as well. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. Or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.